Welcome, dear listeners and newcomers. You are listening to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren from the land of the Geats in Sweden. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you've had a good day so far. Ours is a radio program dedicated to shining a bright light on many of history's cover-ups, fabrications, and lies. Not only by questioning the inconsistencies in the official narrative, but by giving you, as close as we possibly can, an answer to many of the subjects that we uncover. We are well underway towards a brave new era of thought control. We have opinion police and politically correct tyrannies running our lives today. People themselves, deluded by self-righteousness and self-hatred, have become pawns in this game of self-censorship and adopted the role of the enforcer within it. Duped by the promoters of this new system to have the slaves themselves performing this task of control. So speak up, break the spell, and dispel the mythmakers. The time to speak up is now, or forever be silent, and let your children or your grandchildren be the victim of a future that is going to demand their enforcement, the globalists, the rulership, as they out of the chaos seek to bring a new order as they see fit. We don't take this lightly. This is life and death. It's not a joke or something we do as a pastime because we have nothing better to do with our time. This is serious business. And it wasn't us who declared war, by the way. If you have ears to hear, eyes to see, and a brain to perceive, you know that they have been very outspoken about targeting anyone who doesn't go along with their plans. If you want to find out more and hear more radio shows, please go to our website, redicecreations.com. Today we're going to speak about what really happened to Amelia Earhart, the First Lady of Flight. It has some really profound conclusions that go all the way up into the highest levels of the U.S. military and American politics, and also the intrigue of how America was dragged into or pushed into the Second World War by its own highest officials. Mike Campbell spent 9 years as an active duty Navy print and broadcast journalist and 21 years as a Navy civilian writer and Air Force public affairs officer retiring from federal service in 2008. Originally from College Park, Maryland, he is a 1974 graduate of the University of Maryland. After meeting Thomas E. Devine, author of Eyewitness, the Amelia Earhart Incident, in 1988, Campbell became convinced that Devine, Fred Garner, Paul Bryant Jr., and other Earhart researchers were correct in their assessment. We'll speak more about that today. 14 years of collaboration with Devine produced With Our Own Eyes, Eyewitnesses to the Final Days of Amelia Earhart, published in 2002. His second book that we'll get into here today on the Earhart case is called Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last, published in June 2012, greatly expands upon the important eyewitness accounts. The book presents many new findings, testimony, and analysis, as well as never-before-published information from the late Fred Garner's forgotten files that reveals the ongoing institutionalized cover-up of the truth about Amelia's fate at the highest level of the U.S. government. Welcome, Mike. Thank you so much for coming on with us here today. It's great to speak with you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Henrik. So good to be with you. Thank you so much for your interest in this most, most misunderstood piece of American history. So few, so scant few out there are interested and want to learn about this story. And there's so many others that know the truth about this story, and they don't want to touch it. This story is there's no other story like the Earhart disappearance in American culture. So go ahead and you send me in some direction, and I'll be happy to follow and
sure.
to enlighten your listeners, because I can pretty much assure your listeners that they're not going to hear this anywhere else in American media.
You know, that's why we wanted to bring you on and speak more about it. I had no idea initially that there was so much material and testimony regarding this story. But just a brief clarification here for our listeners. You wrote With Our Own Eyes, Eyewitnesses to the Final Days of Amelia Earhart. It was released in about 2002. And then in 2012, he released Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last. And that's what we're going to primarily focus on here today. But there's been a lot of books written about Earhart. What was it that attracted you to write about the story, Mike?
Well, Henrik, in 1988, I was working for the Navy as a civilian reporter, and I was assigned my boss. I worked closely with her, and I worked for the Navy, as I said, as a civilian. We put out a publication called Navy Editor Service. It went out to all Navy ships around the world and all Navy shore stations and Marine shore stations. And it was like a newspaper with Navy policies and feature stories in it. Well, I was assigned to do a story about the Earhart case, just an overview. I had no idea what I was getting into. I got three or four of the books and I began to read. Instantly, I was just sucked right into the whole thing. The first book I read was not one of the better books, but one of the most influential books for the wrong reasons. And it was called Amelia Earhart Lives, and that was the book that that the writers claimed that she returned from Saipan or from Japan and became a New Jersey housewife by the name of Irene Bolam, which was a complete falsehood, you know, as a complete lie. But this book in 1970 made a huge ripple across America. And Irene Bolam had to wind up suing McGraw-Hill for defamation, and they pulled the book after 7 weeks. This book is still available, though. And the book also has some other good things in it. It has other work that was done on Guam and in Saipan with the Saipan witnesses, people that knew about Amelia Earhart's presence on Saipan in 1937, not to jump ahead. But that's where I got started. And one of the books that I found was a book called Eyewitness, the Amelia Earhart Incident by Thomas E. Devine. This book really riveted me. This book is all about Thomas Devine's eyewitness experiences on Saipan in the summer of 1944 when he was a GI during the invasion of Saipan. Now, this book is Devine's account, and it took him over 40 years to write. He was not a writer. It's Devine's account of his eyewitness experiences on Saipan that revealed the presence and death of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan on Saipan during after their arrival there in 1937. Devine saw their airplane three times in one day. The Electra, the Earhart Electra, he saw it three times in one day at his Lido airfield, which was the Japanese airfield, the captured airfield on Saipan. He finally, the third time that Devine saw it, it was in flames. It was destroyed. He didn't understand why. This is all part of, you know, this is all just, this is my first exposure. And I wrote to Devine and I contacted him. I told him what I was doing. He took me into his confidence. Long story short, he shared his information with me that he was privy to in the next 14 or 15 years from other former soldiers who were on Saipan, who came to him as a result of his request at the end of his book, Eyewitness the Amelia Earhart Incident, published in 1987. He asked for other GIs who knew of the presence of Earhart and Noonan on Saipan or of the plane and to contact him. So 26 GIs actually contacted Devine and sent him written accounts. Their accounts are presented in my first book, With Our Own Eyes. Also, in the second book as well, most of them, the important ones, in Truth at Last, Henrik.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. Now, let's back up a little bit here in the story, and just we don't have to spend too much time on this, but what can you say about Earhart, America's first lady of flight, for those who are a bit younger, who aren't too familiar with the story? What kind of background do we need to get here?
Sure. I mean, most people under the age of 50 have never heard of her unless they've heard or unless they've seen stories in the newspapers currently, you know, with the false claims from other groups. But during the 1930s, Amelia Earhart was huge. I mean, there would be no figure today that would even that would even come close to her stature. She was probably the most famous woman in the world, arguably. Eleanor Roosevelt being another one. Between 1930 and 1935, she held 8 women's speed and distance aviation records for For example, in 1932, she became the first woman to fly solo nonstop from coast to coast. She was the first person to solo from Honolulu to Oakland. She flew from Mexico City to Newark, New Jersey. Everything. She wasn't the only female aviator, but she was certainly the best known at, during that time. She was really something. And what really made her star, Henrik, was her Atlantic solo crossing in May 1932, when she flew across the Atlantic Ocean, became the second person and the first woman to do that. She did that in a Lockheed Vega single-engine aircraft, an incredible story. And she, you know, followed in Lindbergh's footsteps, and they, and for that she was called actually Lady Lindy. She picked up a new nickname, and she was she was it from that day on in aviation. She was bigger than any man at that point because Lindbergh had basically retired. Right. He had done his thing.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, she did a lot of different flights, and this was, of course, the last one when she tried to, you know, go around the world, basically, and they failed to reach, was Howland Island in the Central Pacific during their attempt here on, I think it was July 2nd, 1937, but let's just kind of go through it then. What happened to Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan?
Okay, well, we have two versions. We have the official version, and we have the truth. Now, just to give your listeners an idea about the magnitude of the lie about what really happened to her and the official version. If they were to go to Amazon.com and Google the name Amelia Earhart, they would get 2,339 books right now as a result of that Google on Amazon.com. Of those 2,300 plus books, they're going to find almost all of them, virtually all of them, with the exception of a handful, are all about her biography and all about the incredible achievements of her life. Only a few of those books even attempt to explain her disappearance. We'll get to that in a second. You asked what happened. Okay, on July 2nd, 1937, she left Ley, New Guinea. She was her. This was the most important piece of her world trip. Her this was supposed to be her crowning achievement. She was trying to circumnavigate the globe at as near to the equator as she could in this in her Electra 10E, a state-of-the-art aircraft, twin engines, at 1,100 gallons with a 4,000-mile range. And this was the key piece of her trip. She had left June 2nd from Miami, or actually she left from Oakland, but she left this country on June 2nd from Miami. She arrived, you know, she'd take little flights and stop and then just go again. And finally, she arrived at Ley, New Guinea. That was 2,556 miles away from Howland Island, across open Pacific Ocean, a flight that had never been done before. Howland Island was just a speck in the Pacific. But she had Fred Noonan with her. Fred Noonan was the best navigator possible that she could possibly have. They did have the technology in those days to reach that island and to find that island, although it was still primitive by our standards. So I mean, they had to, you know, it was a tough flight. It was scheduled for 20 hours. Or so, roughly, and her last message is another thing. I mean, there's so much involved with this story that I'm always jumping ahead of myself and always trying to squeeze as much as I can. But it's an impossible thing to get across to your readers how much is involved. Yeah, everything that sure. We discuss, Henrik, in the next hour and a half or so, is all in my book. Almost all. Virtually all of it, everything that's important in detail. Now, as far as what happened on her flight, anybody can go to any of these books and find what happened during her flight. Her radio behavior was completely bizarre. She never established two-way communications with the Itasca, which was the Coast Guard cutter that was anchored off of Howland Island with the technology and the radio equipment, the direction-finding equipment to help her to find the island. But she never established two-way communications with them during the whole time. They received only 5 or 6 messages from her the whole time. And the last message was received at 8:44 a.m. Howland time. She said, we're on line of position 157, 337. We're running north and south. We must be on you, but we can't see you. That was just previous to that. Wait, listening on 6210. That was her last message. She was never officially heard from again. Okay.
Why now, the strange behavior, do you think, with the radio here?
Now, this is, well, she was never on the air long enough for the Itasca to get a fix on her. She was only on from 8 to 10 seconds. Bill Galton, one of the radio operators on the Itasca, a Coast Guardsman, told a very well-known Earhart researcher named Paul Rafford, who's 94 years old, still with us. He told him back in the 40s that that woman never intended to land on Howland Island. This was Galton's opinion. He sent her 50 messages that she never responded to. She was never on the air, as I said, for more than 10 seconds. You'd have to see the logs and have to go through it to understand the enormity of the of her strange behavior. So this is one of the reasons why many researchers believe that she never intended to land there, and that it was all a ruse. Now, and you know, this is all, you know, then you're getting into the theoretical and the speculative, which we don't need to do. We have so much to give your listeners as far as what we do know, mm-hmm. the facts that we do know of the case. Okay. So there's no point in doing the other because they can, you know, you can read speculation anywhere. My book presents almost 99.9% facts. Anything that my book presents that's not a fact, I label it as such. Okay. What really happened to Amelia Earhart? Let's get to it.
Sure.
Okay.
Yep.
She landed at Milli Atoll. Milli Atoll is approximately 820 miles northwest of Howland Island. She landed at a right off of shore of an island called Barre Island, B-A-R-R-E Island. She landed there, offshore, you know, she did but she was not, they did not crash. It was a controlled crash land in the water, as much as we can tell. We have witnesses that saw her there. We have 3 eyewitnesses that saw her, many more secondhand witnesses and other witnesses that knew of her landing off of Barre Island. Now, from Barre Island, Henrik, she was picked up by the Japanese. We're not exactly sure when, whether it was a day or whether it was less than a day or 2 days. In that time frame somewhere, she was picked up, we think, by a fishing boat. And then she was transferred to the Japanese survey ship Koshu, K-O-S-H-U. Now, from the Koshu, she was taken to Jalowit, which was the Marshall Islands headquarters of the Japanese. At Jalowit, she was treated by Bilemon Amaron, who was a 16-year-old Japanese born. Actually, I think he was a Japanese. He was born in Japan, but he was half Marshallese, and he was living on Jalowit. He was working for the Japanese because they owned the Marshall Islands in 1937. They were given the Marshalls as a League of Nations mandate. So Bilemon Amaron is one of the most important eyewitnesses. He was called out to the Koshu to treat Fred Noonan's injuries. Fred Noonan had a bandage around his head. He had a head injury and a knee injury. And Bilemon Amaron treated his knee injury and his head injury. And he also saw the white woman on the ship with him. And the people, or the Japanese crewmen aboard the Koshu, called the woman Melia, M-E-E-L-A, Melia. He also identified Noonan as having blue eyes. Now, several researchers went to the Marshalls to interview Bilemon Amaron through the years. At least half a dozen legitimate researchers got a Bilemon Amaron story from him, and they're in several books. Getting back to the books, as I was saying, there's about 2,300 books about Amelia. but there's less than a handful of legitimate books about her disappearance that actually present the truth or any pieces of the truth about her disappearance. This is the incredible part of the story that so many people have assiduously avoided looking into the truth about Amelia Earhart. Now, okay, we'll get back to that in a second.
Sure. Yeah.
But okay, from Jalowit, we have witnesses that know that saw her at Jalowit besides Billamon. But from Jalowit, she was taken to Kwajalein, also Kwajalein Atoll, very close to Jalowit Atoll. From Kwajalein, she was kept at Roy Namur for an unspecified amount of time. But we have other witnesses that knew of her presence at Roy Namur. Okay. Also, we have American servicemen who, in 1944, found evidence of her at Roy Namur during the in July of 1944 during the invasion of Kwajalein. So, from Kwajalein, she was then taken to Saipan by seaplane, we believe. About 1,500 miles would be the trip from Kwajalein to Saipan by seaplane. That was not a difficult trip. They did have the technology to make that trip. Now, from Saipan, from Kwajalein to Saipan, Amelia and Noonan were flown, and there they landed at Tanapag Harbor, Saipan, on the west coast of Saipan in 1937, summertime time frame. Okay, now that is where the modern day search for Amelia Earhart really begins. Okay, that's where we have the first legitimate book to present the truth. In Paul Briant's 1960 book, Daughter of the Sky, the Story of Amelia Earhart. Briant was a Air Force Academy English teacher who was writing a garden variety biography of Amelia Earhart when, at the end of his book, he was presented with some new information which came to him courtesy of Casimir Schecht, who was a Navy lieutenant, who was a dentist, who had worked on Saipan in the late 40s. And at that time, well, of course, the United States won Saipan in 1944. Right. And this young woman, who was her Casimir Schecht's dental assistant, told Casimir Schecht about her childhood experience of seeing the American flyers land at Tanapag Harbor. And this was presented in presented this account at the end of his book, Daughter of the Sky. And this is what ignited the modern day search for Amelia Earhart. I think it's important to read this because this is really profound. This is really where, you know, this is before, you know, When Briant's book came out, I mean, it caught the American elites with their pants down. I mean, only a few people in the American government, of course, were smart about this, that really knew about what happened to her, okay, for reasons we'll get into as we proceed.
Yeah.
But at this point, this book and this last chapter in this book was an absolute bombshell, okay? So, in the summer of, I'm reading now from the chapter, quoting, in the summer of 1937, Josephine was riding her bicycle toward Tanapag Harbor. She was taking her Japanese brother-in-law, J.Y. Matsumoto, his lunch and was hurrying along because it was nearly 12 o'clock. Josephine had a special pass to the Japanese military area near the harbor. Not even Japanese civilians were admitted to the area unless they carried the proper credentials. The young girl rode up to the gate, stopped her bicycle, and presented her pass. The guard allowed her into the restricted area. On the way to meet her brother-in-law, Josephine heard an airplane flying overhead. She looked up and saw a silver twin-engine plane. The plane seemed to be in trouble, for it came down low, headed out into the harbor, and belly landed on the water. It was not until she met her brother-in-law that Josephine discovered that who it was who had crash-landed in the harbor. Quote, "The American woman," everybody was saying, greatly excited. "Come and see the American woman." Josephine and her brother-in-law joined the knot of people who gathered to watch. She watched the American woman standing next to a tall man wearing a short-sleeved sports shirt and was surprised because the woman was not dressed as a woman usually dressed. Instead of a dress, the American woman wore a man's shirt and trousers, and instead of long hair, she wore her hair cut short like a man. The faces of the man and woman were white and drawn as if they were sick. Okay, end of quote. Now, Briant added in his book, which is very important, and which is the fact that Fred Gerner, who we'll get to very shortly, also did. He added that Josephine had identified a photo of Earhart and Noonan as absolutely being that of the same man and woman she saw on Saipan in 1937. Mm. Okay, that was the bombshell. Okay,
yeah.
that was the big one. Now, you want to get something in or continue?
No, it's all good. I was going to actually get, this is one of the testimonies I did want to talk about because it's just so important. And then I believe this is later picked up then by radio newsman Fred Gorner, correct? And he's kind of the one who gets this story out to America. Is that how it unfolded?
Yes, the best way to pronounce his name is Gerner.
As if it's an E.
It's Gerner, Fred Gerner. Well, we're skipping one step. In between Josephine's account as presented in Briant's book, then we have the San Mateo Times and Linwood Day. Linwood Day was a reporter for the San Mateo Times, and he read this, and he went and he interviewed Josephine, and he believed her story, and he started to do stories about Josephine, and these stories appeared in the San Mateo Times beginning in late May of 1960, and I sent you two headlines, and you have them. One of them is on my wall right now, and I keep this framed. And the other one was the first story that he actually did was about Josephine's claim, where she claimed that what's it say here? I'm trying to go to it now. I'm trying to find San Mateo says Japanese executed Amelia Earhart. This was huge in this country. This was a San Mateo Times, a small newspaper out of San Francisco. Now, this was Linwood Day's interview with Josephine. So Josephine was living there, of course, and she had moved from Saipan. And Fred Gerner saw this and was immediately captivated. He went and he interviewed Josephine. And he believed her story, mm-hmm. and soon thereafter, Gerner, who was a newsman for KCBS radio in San Francisco, already a household name in that part of the country, Gerner was. He went to Saipan in June of 1960. It was the first of four of his trips to Saipan between then and 1964, I believe, or 63, and then his book was published in 1966. As a result of Gerner's first trip to Saipan, we have the San Mateo Times on July 1st, 1960, publishing their blockbuster story, Amelia Earhart, Mystery is Solved. Subhead, famed aviatrix died on Saipan. This story was the result of Gerner's initial investigations on Saipan, where he found 200 native Saipanese that he interviewed, 13 of them corroborated Josephine's story in various ways. Now, it's important to understand that the Saipanese on Saipan in 1937 were not supposed to know about Amelia Earhart being there. Mm-hmm. This was a closed colony. This was a Japanese protectorate. They owned that place, and they treated the Saipanese people very badly, they weren't supposed to know about it. But the word did leak out. Josephine was one of the ones that saw it. She was in a classified area that they were working on their seaplane base there, probably, and some other military installations. So Gerner found 13 people that were willing to talk to him. Most of the Saipanese that he found on Saipan knew about her presence there, But they were afraid to tell him about it because this was 1960, only 16 years after the war, or 15 years after the war, and they were still afraid that the Japanese were going to come back. They weren't convinced that they were safe yet. Okay, it was just too close. So many of them were just afraid to tell him about it,
okay.
What they knew. But Gerner found 13 that he did that weren't too scared to tell him what they believe, what they knew, and he got their accounts through the missionary priests on Saipan. They were translated. They translated because these Saipanese didn't speak English, and they spoke mostly Spanish. And the Japanese or the Spanish priest on Saipan translated for Gerner. Gerner was vehement about this, about having the priest do this, because he knew that he would be criticized by the skeptics, and he wanted to make sure that he would be getting the truth as close to the truth as he could from the Saipanese witnesses. And he knew that these people, by and large, were very serious Catholics in those days, and they were afraid of those priests, and they were afraid to lie to them.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So that means, though, that were the Catholic priests, were they Spanish, or what were...
They were for the most part Spanish. One of them was American that spoke Spanish. Father Sylvan Conover was his name.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the key figures. He was involved with several of the different investigations. But I think there's about three or four priests, and they were with Gerner throughout his at least his first investigation on Saipan.
Were they, it's a kind of a side note here, but were they helpful? Were they willing to speak with him about what they saw as well?
Very much so. They were very willing to help Gerner. They also knew, not firsthand, none of them had been on the island in 1937, but they knew of the native stories. They knew of the accounts of Amelia being on Saipan. They had no doubt that it was true, and they wanted the truth to get out. Catholic priests, they're all about the truth.
So let's see, I don't want to jump ahead too much here, but a little bit later, obviously, I do want to get into, one of the reasons why Earhart was treated in the way she was. This is still back in 37. I'm not too sure how the relationships between the U.S. and the Japanese were at the time, but obviously they didn't officially kind of enter into it until the 40s when Japan and China conflict started, and then, of course, 41 with Pearl Harbor. But what was the temperature like, do you think, between America and Japan in 37?
It was not good. It was warming up very quickly. The Marshall Islands, where Amelia landed, was verboten to Westerners. Anybody that wanted to go to anywhere in the Marshalls or the Mariana Islands in those days from the West needed special permission, and very few even bothered to ask because they were most likely to be denied. Back in the 20s, Pete Ellis, the famous American Marine spy, was found out by the Japanese during the time he was on Palau, and he died a very miserable death under the Japanese when they found him there. In 1937, things were just getting worse, and both countries made. The appearance, they kept up the appearance officially that they were doing okay between each other, but behind the scenes, it's all been learned that things were getting very bad. We know that the Japanese were preparing for war, and we know that we weren't at the time officially. We were in a very bad condition militarily. We were isolationists at the time, but that Japan was Japan was continuing their aggression in the Pacific area, and in 1937 they attacked China.
Let me ask you about obviously because Earhart wanted to reach Howland Island. Let's just get a kind of a sense of the map here a little bit and how she ended up then on Saipan. Because if this was the temperature at the times, obviously would it have been problematic for her where she was intending to go? Did she need, papers for this to fly over this airspace, what have you? How did that work out?
No, Howland Island was an American or British, I think a dual possession at that time. It was right in the middle of the Pacific, Central Pacific area, and it was not a Japanese possession at that time. It wasn't part of the League of League of Nations mandate that gave the Marshals and the Northern Marianas to the Japanese. So no, it was okay. The United States had put a temporary airstrip on Howland. There had been much preparation made, and she was good to go if she could find Howland. Right. So that wasn't part of the problem.
Right.
But the Japanese did know. Of course, the whole world knew what she was doing, and they were very much interested in her flight, as they naturally would have been. And they had better radio communications, and they had better direction finding abilities than we did at the time. And if anybody could have tracked her, it was them at the time. However, she wasn't on the air long enough, probably even for the Japanese, to get a fix on her. 10 seconds was just not long enough. Her radio behavior was so bizarre. That's the real mystery. The true mystery, Heinrich, about the Earhart matter is not what happened to her. It's not that she was taken to Saipan and she died there in Japanese captivity. That is what is known. It's an open secret, okay? It's available to anybody that wants to find it. Although our American establishment media will never direct anyone there, and they will, and it's found in very few books, but it's there for those that want to find it. The real mystery is why and how she landed at Milley. Was it a mistake?
Right.
Was she too far north of Howland, and she went to Milley because she knew that they had a powerful radio transmitter at Jellawit, that she knew that if she followed that she could find a landfall? Or Milley was only 1,600 miles direct flight from Le New Guinea. I'm not saying that they flew there directly, but that's how far it was. They could have done a roundabout. You know, this is possible. They could have been asked to overfly truck. Okay. That's the spy theory, but which is, we don't have any hard evidence to support the spy theory. We have lots of circumstantial evidence that does support the spy theory.
Tell us more about it anyway, for those who want to. I mean, because that is an interesting possibility here. If you do look at a map like I'm doing right now, you can look at, Howland Island. It's about as far away from Hawaii on the towards the east as it is towards Saipan, towards the west, approximately. Uh-huh. So it's a long ways away. So the question is exactly as you said: what are they doing over there? Why the radio communication? Let's just speculate a little bit here, if we can. What do you think about the spy theory then?
I think I don't like to use the word spy to begin with. Okay, the connotations of that word have become so negative. She may have been asked by FDR to overfly truck and have a look. It would have been 7 o'clock in July, 7 p.m., and she would have been able to see and get a good idea what was going down at truck. She might have been able to take some snapshots. No hard evidence has ever been produced that shows that she had any sort of high-tech cameras aboard that plane. Mm-hmm. Okay, that has not been proven. She did have a handheld camera that she could have snapped some photos. It's possible that she could have been asked to overfly truck. We were hurting for intelligence information at that time about truck. Submarines, of course, we had submarines in the area, but they didn't have aerial capabilities. And it is an outside possibility. If she was asked to overfly truck, it would have extended her trip to Howland to about 3,300 miles instead of 2,500 plus miles. And it would have really stretched her capability fuel-wise.
Right.
It's possible. I am really at a loss as to why. When I say it's a mystery, it is. It is truly a mystery to researchers. Why? To honest researchers. Now, we're talking about researchers that are really, that don't have axes to grind and aren't trying to prove that she went down somewhere else, which are the ones that are making all the news in this country and around the world anymore. Now, I'm talking about honest researchers that really study the facts as they are known. We don't know. We simply don't know.
Yeah, it's the reason why I think it is an interesting theory as well is that there have been other cases later on where You know, celebrities and known people have been used in various cases for intelligence because they do have a capability of, you know, getting behind enemy lines, so to speak. And of course, the whatever country they end up in, if they're a big celebrity, they're going to be, you know, amazed to have them there, and it's going to be a, you know, a fun thing for them. But people don't know usually that they're an agent and doing just might be a very tiny aspect, might be a minor thing that they're doing. But nonetheless, we don't have to go too lost in this. But my point there being,
well,
that,
here's the thing, you know, now that we're on it, I mean, here's the thing. If they were asked to do that, then it was really one of the major theories that has been put out is that they were asked to do that, or in combination with that, they were asked to land at Mille on purpose so that the United States Navy could come in and look for them,
right,
as an,
yeah,
excuse.
Exactly.
This is the other piece of the possible spy idea. Okay, but the Japanese were not going to be impressed with the fact that she was a celebrity whatsoever. And if that was the plan, that was the most ill-conceived plan in American intelligence history, because the United States immediately asked the Japanese if they could search the marshals. And the Japanese said, not only no, but hell no.
Right.
You are not going to search the marshals. We will search the marshals.
Yeah.
And that was the end of that.
Was the, do you think the accusations that she and Noonan was a spy, were their suspicions justified, Japan's suspicions justified, do you think?
Well, we don't know. We really just don't know. If we don't know, if they actually were asked to do this. There is a lot of evidence. There's even one individual who told us, and his name's Art Kennedy, and he claims that she told him that she was asked to be a spy, but Kennedy was known to be an embellisher and exaggerate things, and so. We're not, one person's account is not quite enough.
Sure, you need to correlate it with some other people, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So as I said, I mean, when I say we don't know, we just don't know, it's quite likely. Let's say it is likely. There has to be some explanation as to why she had such terrible radio communications with the Itasca. And the other explanations that have been put forward are not acceptable to me or to others who I respect.
Who do you know? Who did she own the plane herself? Was it issued, borrowed to her?
Oh, she absolutely owned the plane herself.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
bought for her, and it was bought for her in 1935 by contributions and by Purdue University was involved. Contributors to Purdue. She had some sort of an association with Purdue University. Her husband was also pretty well off. He was the publisher, the famous publisher, George Palmer Putnam. The plane cost $80,000 in 1935 money.
That's a lot.
So yeah. I don't know what that would be today, but I think it would be at least a couple million.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the plane was state of the art for the time, and it was a good plane. And there was no reason for them not to reach Halland if they were really trying. That's an opinion. Okay, mm-hmm. That is an opinion from there's been so many people that have tried to prove that she went down early, and that the Navy and the Coast Guard, who did a 262,000 mile radius search around Howland Island after her loss.
I
mean, that is an incredible amount of area that they searched. And
I think you had a number in the book where you said about they'd spend estimately about $4 million on the search.
Well, yes, that's a figure that they used in those days. That they spent in 1937 dollars, $4 million for the search. That's an astronomical figure.
Sure.
Now.
Yeah.
But even in those days, they wouldn't have spent that kind of money on anybody. Let's put it that way.
Right.
On just anyone.
Yeah, of course.
They were vitally concerned with her. Now, there is the question though, however, that there really is a legitimate question. Was the search real, or was the search a ruse, you know, because we know recent research, just recent research, that's not in my book. I mean, it's come to light. Things have come to light even since 2012 when my book was published, that indicate that our government knew that the Japanese had her get ready for this within 2 weeks. Within 2 weeks, because of our ability to crack their translate their radio transmissions and get them to where they could be translated. We had cracked their codes in 1937, all their codes, all their naval codes, and all their other official codes, ambassador codes, or whatever they call them. The word escapes me now. But they couldn't keep a secret from us. If we translated something from them, we could translate it. And there's new evidence that tells us that they didn't even have to wait long before they knew that the Japanese had her in 1937.
Now, a little bit later here, we're going to speak more. We'll save that to the second segment here, but more about the cover-up and kind of the politics behind this, and of course, how many people and publications you've been, you know, fighting with a lot of publications try to get this information out, and their refusal to touch some of these things. But what else do we should we know when it comes to the capture and the fate of Noonan and Earhart before we kind of move on here?
Well, we know basically that they were kept. They were kept on Saipan, first in a jail. There was a jail there, a prison. They were kept there for a while. Then we know that Amelia was kept. They were then separated. This is all according to witnesses telling us that they were separated. Noonan was kept at a military facility on Saipan, and that she was kept mostly in the hotel there on Saipan. Under Japanese surveillance, of course, and they knew where she wasn't going anywhere, but she had the freedom of the hotel and the grounds, and there were several a couple female witnesses that did her clothes for her, that actually had interactions with her, and they were told later that she died from dysentery. The time element is not exact; we're not exactly sure. Other people were told that she was shot and executed as a spy. I mean, the witness, we have so many different witness accounts, you know, that place her not only on Saipan, but in the Marshall Islands. And that's only the native witnesses that we're talking about. There's a whole new, you know, the whole other piece I mentioned briefly was the GIs on Saipan, the 26 GIs on Saipan in 1944. Who were privy to the presence of her plane being discovered there, and other things that they learned that they were told by other witnesses on Saipan or saw or found themselves. I mean, it just goes on and on. There's so much involved.
Yeah, so about 7 years later, then America came there in about 1944, and this happened in 1937. So about 7 years, and of course there was widespread you know, bombing campaigns on certain islands and whatnot, but you did have a photo in your book where you showed that even some of the hangar buildings and things like this were actually still standing by the time the Americans got there, I believe.
Yes, they were. That was one of the earlier criticisms of the skeptics about why the plane couldn't have been found in a hangar. That Thomas Devine used to get once in a while, that the critics would say, well, we bombed their Saipan into smithereens. There couldn't have been anything standing. There couldn't have been a hangar standing. Well, there were. There were hangars that were standing. They were none the worse for wear, but they were still standing.
Yep. Remarkably, yeah, exactly. It was just a slaughter, of course, as it was during those times. But let's see if there's anything else here before we're going to take a short break in a little bit. We'll talk a little bit more about the book and the websites and whatnot here, but let's see if there's anything else we should cover before we do that. I don't know if it's too prematurely here, but you have a chapter in the book where you talk about graves as well. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we have two major, we have three claims as to the location of the Earhart gravesite on Saipan. There are three competing claims. And one of those claims is far more credible than the other two claims. And I believe the one that's the most credible, of course. And but it's all very fascinating stuff. Do you want to begin about the graves?
Tell us a bit about it. Let's spend a few minutes on that before we talk about the websites here.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. The first gravesite claim was from Thomas Devine, who wrote "I Witnessed the Amelia Earhart Incident" in 1987. It was published, and Devine claims that in 1945, August, he was shown the gravesite of an American man and woman who had come from the sky by a Okinawan woman who was on the island. He was a GI, of course, on Saipan. He had stayed behind on Saipan with the garrison force, and he was out on Saipan looking around. He was always like exploring Saipan, and GIs would always be looking for souvenirs or whatever and going through the countryside. And he was accosted by this Okinawan woman one day who told him that she was shown this spot, and that was the gravesite of an American man and woman that came from the sky. He took that to mean that they flew there, and that was the gravesite of Earhart and Noonan. That's the first claim. The second claim comes from Buddy Brennan, who was another researcher who went to Saipan in the mid-80s, who made two trips to Saipan. Brennan was told by a Saipanese woman named Nieva Cabrera Blas that she saw a white woman shot in 1944, about 2 or 3 weeks before the American invasion of Saipan in June. Mrs. Bloss said that she saw this American woman executed by the Japanese and buried in a hole there. She showed Brennan the spot. Brennan excavated that spot and found no bones, except he did find a blindfold that he claimed, he found a rag that he claimed was the blindfold used for Amelia Earhart. That became the basis of his book, Witness to the Execution. That was published in 1988, ironically by the same company that published Devine's book. That's the second claim. The third claim is much more credible, and I believe it to be the one that's the true claim of the true gravesite of Earhart on Saipan. And that is the claim that was made by Everett Henson Jr. and Billy Burks, who were two Marines on Saipan in 1944. They were accosted by a Marine captain whose name was Tracy Griswold. He was working in Marine intelligence on Saipan. This was after the island had been secure, approximately late July or early August time frame on Saipan. Griswold took these two privates to a spot outside the Liang Cemetery on Saipan, took them to a spot, told them to dig. They dug at the spot and they found bones. They excavated those bones. The bones were of two skeletons. They knew that was two skeletons because they found two skulls with the bones. They were skeletal remains. When they were done with the detail, Everett Henson Jr. asked Griswold, "What are we doing, and who are these people?" And Henson made the only mistake that he would make. He told the two, he said, "Have you ever heard of Amelia Earhart?" They said, "Of course." He said, "Enough said then." He swore them to secrecy, never to say a word about it. They never said a word about that detail for 24 years until they heard about Gerner's investigation and, you know, the San Mateo Times and all that. In 1965, they told Gerner's close confidant, Russ Game, about what happened to them, and Gerner investigated their claims.
Right.
I could go on with that. There's more, much more to that story.
Oh, sure. We can definitely go a little bit deeper into that later here, Mike. But let's give out some of the details here. Obviously, the book we're talking about is Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last. It was released in 2012. Where can people go to pick up a copy of the book if they want to read more about the details here?
It's Amazon.com, and you know, just go to Amazon.com and you can Google my name or the title, or you can go to my blog. I'd really appreciate it if you come to my blog and give that a look too. I've been working on this blog since 2012, July. I now have 67 posts, I believe, and many of the posts are in excess of 3,000 word posts. I'm going into every aspect of the Earhart matter that I possibly can, and I really work hard on this blog. This isn't something that I just throw together, and I really update it about with everything that I'm finding that's releasable at this point. Most of the things that we're learning are releasable, and there's just a whole wealth of information on my blog, Heinrich, and it's earharttruth.wordpress.com. Everybody that knows about blogs knows about the WordPress blog company or whatever. So it's Earhart Truth, one word, earharttruth.wordpress.com. And from there, they can link to Amazon and get the book.
Yep, very good. And of course, you do have earharttruth.com as well, just straight up there, where you have some links and links to the blog as well. We'll have both of these up and links to the book as well, so people can click through easily from our website here. But yeah, this is fascinating. Looking forward to speaking more with you here, Mike, in the second segment. Stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Mike, and we'll be right back. Well, don't miss the exciting second hour as we continue with Mike Campbell and go deeper into the U.S. military and government to discuss some of the most probable possibilities of what happened to Amelia Earhart and why. Why is this cover-up even an important issue, right? How does it relate to the start of the Second World War and also one of the most praised politicians in American history? Well, all I can say is that the fabrication around the Roosevelts as great humanitarians, bringers of peace, and the declaration of human rights, the victory over the most evil regime in the history of mankind, together with FDR's mass-murdering friend Uncle Joe, will come crashing down like the house of cards that it is. There's just so much hypocrisy around this particular time period, and it's almost like, where do you begin, right? But we'll give you another layer to this intrigue in the next hour. To hear more, go to redicemembers.com and sign up and tune in to this fascinating and important second hour with Mike Campbell. We have all the shows for you going back to 2006, close to 1,000 programs on a lot of the topics that we find to be interesting and important. We have much more coming, by the way. We have Patrick Wood next on The Rise of the Technocrats. Then we have Brian Anspatrick Mike Walsh, Christopher Hell, Alex Newman, Ken Rola, Daniel Friberg, and many more after this. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned. We'll see you on the other side of this break.